Calling the case of Miller versus Pavelich, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's June 20th, 2024. This is a Zoom session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Counsel will each have 15 minutes for primary argument. Appellant's counsel will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There's a timekeeping mechanism up in the corner of the screen. Can each of the attorneys see that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Again, Your Honor.
Perfect. Be mindful of the time on the clock. And also attempts by the judges to ask questions. I think it's sometimes more difficult to interrupt people on Zoom than it is in person. We'll do our best raising a hand, or I might interrupt you if it seems that one of the panel judges' attempt to ask a question is going unnoticed. The hearing this morning is audio recorded and is available to the public. No other recordings are permitted. With that, we'll proceed with arguments, and each of the attorneys should be sure to state his name for the record before each leg of the argument so you're identified on the oral recording. Counsel for appellant may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Rep McSweeney on behalf of James Miller in this action over the granting of summary judgment in the district court in this matter. We believe that the court wrongly relied on a narrow instance of contract law in the WICA State Farm versus WICA Casualty and incorrectly defined intent. We believe that the correct intent in this action should have been drawn from Snell, which is the rule containing elements of intent are whether or not the party intended the action. And in this case, it's very clear that the defendant intended the outcome of the harm done to my client. The WICA case is grounded in contract law and was very narrowly
Counsel,
decided.
I apologize for interrupting you so soon. So if you want to return to your thoughts on the WICA case, I hope you get it. I'm sure you will get a chance to do that. I just want to stop you briefly because you relied on the Sell case. And I don't see that as a debate in this case. I see the opposing brief as agreeing with you that the Sell definition may be applied. I know it's not cited in the district court's decision, but I'm not quite sure how that gets you to what you're looking for, which is a reversal of the summary judgment issue. I think that the district court's view was that the only evidence in this case suggests that, and of course, it's not the defendant, it is the decedent here, right? That
correct.
The decedent was incompetent. At the time of the act, as opposed to merely at the time of trial, and that the only evidence offered is this Rule 20 evaluation. So how do you respond to that as opposed to the standard of intent?
Well, I think, Your Honor, I think you're at the absolute, you're at the point of the case, and that's our feeling is that the district court judge relied on a very truncated version of the evidence in that Rule 20 report. His opinion was that the decedent met Minnesota's criteria for the excusal of criminal liability due to mental illness based on a few small snippets of Dr. Bowerman's report and excluded whole sections of the report that were completely contradictory. And I can point your honors to a few of them.
So
on page
I understand, right, that you're essentially asking us to take the favorable view of the doctor's report, the Rule 20 report, favorable to your position. And then from that, go where? We're going to find that the decedent, what? Fill in the blanks for me, because I don't want to argue for you. I'd like to hear it from you.
Yeah, you're going to find, I think, clearly by looking at Judge Bowerman's report in its entirety, that the decedent indeed had the intent under Snell to cause the harm to my client, James Miller. And I'll point to a couple portions in that report that illuminate that. On page 25, paragraph 2, line 18 of Dr. Bowerman's report, he stated that Mr. Pavlich acknowledged that he knew acting out in violence against a person or their property was wrong. In the same report, On page 8, paragraph 3, the last line is, however, he reported the following thought process and prepared intentions under certain circumstances. If someone does something to me, then I definitely want to hurt them. If you take those two small snippets of the report, I can cite many others inside the report that show the contradiction in the district judge's conclusions. It certainly shows, following Snell, that the decedent, when confronted with the situation where he felt that he'd been poisoned, which is the fact, uncontroverted fact in this case, he was going to react just in the way that he described to Dr. Bowerman. He was going to respond with violence and hurt them. And that's exactly what he intended to do, and that's what he did.
Muted myself. The other line of questions I want to make sure I hear your answer on, and then I'll let you go with your argument, is the respondent has, and you've responded in your reply brief, the respondent has argued that you have shifted theories on appeal, right? And so, for instance, in the district court, you actually advocated for application of the WICA case and made more of this factual argument that you just repeated. But that now on appeal, you're saying WIC is the wrong standard. And in addition to that, I read your brief to say, and maybe I'm misunderstanding it, so you know, help me out here. But you're saying things like using psychiatric evidence is inappropriate to determine intent in this context. I'm seeing that on page 16 of your opening brief. In your reply brief, you advocate for bifurcating inquiries into intent and capacity and allow the jury to consider factual findings within the Bowerman report when evaluating intent. So I see some contradictions in your argument, which I find confusing, the use and non-use of the Bowerman report, relevant, not relevant. And then this idea that there should be some bifurcation. I don't see any evidence that those are issues presented to the district court. And so are you raising new issues on appeal, and should this court consider them?
Well, I know that we addressed this in our reply brief, and central to the case and what was argued at the district court level, Your Honor, was intent. Intent formed the basis of the opinion at the district court. Intent was the overarching issue. Obviously, in our initial brief, we did not cite the Silberstein case. We have raised it at the Court of Appeals, and I would point to the four-factor test that's been established for any additional evidence or different arguments that are presented at the Court of Appeals, and I think that we squarely satisfy all four. This is definitely a novel issue. It doesn't seem that case law is decided completely on point in Minnesota. So we're trying to provide as much case law and evidence to the Court of Appeals to be able to make an informed decision as possible. And we believe that the Silberstein case is absolutely on point, as are the additional arguments that we've raised. Again, intent was raised prominently in the briefing at the district court level.
I apologize, counsel, if my question wasn't clear. It isn't so much that I'm concerned about intent being a continuing theme between the district court and on appeal. I you know, for what it's worth, and I don't speak for the panel, it seems to me that that is a continuing theme on everyone's and with regard to what the district court decided. What I'm asking you about is these very narrow arguments that you've made, but are sweeping in their significance, saying things like psychiatric evidence isn't relevant to determine intent, and that we should remand this case for some kind of bifurcated proceedings. To me, those read like brand new arguments on appeal. Am I wrong that they're new?
I would say that they're continuations of the question as to intent and how the district court is to handle the issue of intent in a psychiatric based defense. And I point to the Bauman case that says just that capacity and intent are two independent assertions, and that the psychiatric evidence goes to capacity, not to intent.
Mr. McSweeney, this is, I'm sorry, Judge Bradfield, did you want to, on one point, you and Mr. Witte seem to agree because at page 5 of his brief, he says that the issue before the court is a novel legal issue. In fact, you just talked about it being novel. And so if it's novel, do you think this case should be precedential? And what would your rule of law be that comes out of this case, if you think it should be?
Yeah, I think it's consistent with what the prior case law shows. Our tort system is based to favor those that are harmed that are able to receive compensation and damages. In fact, if you read the WICA opinion, it seems to twist itself to get to that result. It construes the contract law to allow for coverage so that people that are harmed get compensation. The law going forward and the precedential value of an opinion in this case should remand it so that the law in Minnesota would be, with all of the mental illness caused by drug addiction and the host of issues that we have, that the state of Minnesota has not granted a complete free pass for anybody operating under mental illness to harm others. And that the law in Minnesota is to protect those people that are harmed. In the criminal setting, Your Honor, we understand that we do not want mentally infirmed people to be in general populations of prisons. And so we've set up a civil commitment system to keep them from harming others in a prison setting or being harmed themselves. But the system was never designed to allow people in the public who are able to manifest the intent to harm someone else. There's nothing in this record that suggests that Mr. Pavlich did not intend to pick up a pipe and bash Mr. Miller's skull. So it's a public policy that favors the compensation to victims over the protection of financial assets of those that harm others.
So, counsel, I'd like to direct your attention, if I could, to a section of the restatement that's cited in the WICA case. I mean, I appreciate that you think WICA is inapplicable here, but the Supreme Court's analysis certainly does discuss, you know, the impact of mental illness on intent. And the court cites 895J, deficient mental capacity. Are you familiar with that section of the restatement, second of torts?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
All right. And so, because I didn't see it cited in either party's briefs, and so I'm just, and it's, as I said, WICA was cited it favorably. And so I'm just curious about, in terms of us seeking authority for the broader rulings that you're suggesting, I don't see authority for that in existing precedent. So if we were to turn to something, you know, of a broader source like the restatement, is that something that you think is appropriate? Do you seek supplemental briefing on it? I mean, what's your thinking on the applicability of this section of the restatement?
Well, if the court would seek additional briefing, I think that would be the appropriate time for me to respond. But I think I've articulated a pretty sound public policy that favors people harmed.
You have, counsel. Don't think I don't hear you. What I'm struggling with is the case law that would suggest, remembering that we're an error-correcting court and we don't adopt as a general rule. You know, we don't make new rules of law in this court. We do settle questions of first impression, but we try to do so with ample authority behind us. And so that's what I'm looking for, is the authority that supports your public policy analysis. I don't see it in any of the cases that you cited. So, you know, maybe.
Well,
maybe.
Your Honor, I believe that the ruling in WICA absolutely supports it. They say that the act could have been intentional, but the coverage should still apply. Still doing whatever they can to favor compensation to victims.
Well, because you've got time for rebuttal, I'll just give you my short take on the WICA decision. And it's really not me. I mean, if you read all through the procedural history of the Silberstein case, that case did get remanded to this court for an unpublished decision that was not cited by either party. And the unpublished decision was very clear, you know, that WICA is a case very specific to an insurance contract that it involves an exception to the contract, and because the rules of law are that exceptions to an insurance contract are narrowly construed against the insurer, that the case really isn't all that helpful as offering broad principles of tort law because it's a contract case. So, I mean, I hear your public policy arguments. Surely there must be authority out there for those in the tort context. I just don't see that WICA is that authority for you. And I actually read your brief to argue something similar. So I don't know. Counsel, I'll leave the rest to you. And of course, you've got rebuttal as well.
Your Honor, I'd be happy to brief it, but we've spent, I know the defense and myself have spent extensive time looking at this, and it really is a novel issue before this court and a case of first impression.
All right, let's hear from counsel for respondent. Could you identify yourself for the record before you begin?
Good morning, Your Honor. Scott Witte. Appearing on behalf of Taria Lewis, who is the personal representative of the estate of Mark Pavlich, deceased. Thank you, and may it please the honorable panel. I think to drive to the issue that I see as most meaningful here and important, there is no dispute that intent is a required element of both assault and battery. Since it's required, the absence of any evidence in a record upon which a summary judgment motion is decided is would warrant dismissal, which happened in this case. Based on the summary judgment standards that we all know well, I think it is there's no dispute that some evidence of each element of a claim, something more than conclusory allegations, must be present to survive summary judgment. There is a standard case law citations that we all use indicating that as much as substantial evidence to show a genuine issue of material fact must be presented. Likewise, the non-moving party has to offer significant probative evidence supporting its claim or those elements. The district court correctly found, Your Honor, here that the uncontroverted evidence in the record upon which he had to make a decision was the at least as to the issue of intent was the report of Dr. Bowerman. Any speculation about what evidence might come into the case later is not part of what we're dealing with on summary judgment. And even though that evidence, that is Dr. Bowerman's report, must be viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff here, there's still it must be actual evidence to support an argument that their intent can be established. And here there's no affidavit of the plaintiff, there's no police report, there's no nothing of that sort that gave the district court judge
Counsel,
any.
if you don't mind, I hear you getting to exactly the point I'd appreciate you discussing, which is if we take Dr. Bowerman's report and view it in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, so Mr. Miller here, there certainly are sections of the report, and in fact, the very same sections that the district court turned to support its decision to grant summary judgment, where there are conclusions made by the doctor that suggests that Mr. Pa am I saying it correctly? Is it Pavlich? Yeah.
Pavlich, Your Honor.
Okay. So that Mr. Pavlich did truly believe his life was in imminent danger and directly acted to save himself. You know, again, believing it was delusional, but believing that this beer had been spiked and was poisoned to him, and that's why he acted as he did. So that if that evidence and the appellant has cited other sections of the report, some of them are actually Mr. Pavlich's own statements about what he thought and did at the time, you know, understanding that he did hit Mr. Miller. He understood that. He didn't think he hit him so hard, you know, something comments along those lines. So if that evidence is viewed favorably to the appellant, which is what we have to do on summary judgment, I mean, this isn't about the merits, right? It's just about summary judgment. Then, you know, isn't there a genuine issue of material fact?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason is this was a very comprehensive report. The importance of the report that I think the district court latched onto properly were the was the conclusion section of the report, and that talked about really unambiguously that Mr. Pavlich was laboring under such a defect of reason due to mental illness and cognitive impairment, so as not to know the nature of the act. Or that it was wrong. I think that is
what. If you want to stop there for a second, I mean, that's not the Victor v. Sell standard that you say is applicable in your brief. I mean, that is the standard for Rule 20 for sure. I mean, this is a Rule 20 report, and you know the doctor did exactly what he was asked to do. But it's not the Victor v. Sell standard. And then you know there are other parts of that very same conclusion, right, from Dr. Bowerman that go. And again, I'm reading this in a light favorable to Mr. Miller, that suggests that Mr. Palachek had capacity to formally understand that assault is immoral and illegal. That's what the doctor concluded. So,
you know, I think just addressing and I mean the report says what it says, and you and I are both speaking directly from it, I believe, and that is to know the nature of what you are doing would call, I think, not meet the Victor v. Sell intent requirement or standard that we're talking about. It would be knowing, intending to do what you do, but also intending to cause the outcome that you would intend to cause. And I think not knowing the nature of what you're doing, perhaps there are sentences if in that conclusion section from Dr. Bowerman that you and I now reading it in this context would not see to fit piece by piece or one alongside the other. But there were a conglomeration of facts and information that she was using to develop an opinion as to whether he had the ability to understand what he was doing, thus intending to do the act that he wants to, but also intending the outcome, the consequence that he was intending. So I do believe that can be read and should be read to say that he didn't know what he was doing, he didn't know why he was doing it, and thus how can you intend then to aim for the consequences that would be substantially likely to occur and fall in line with the cell definition that we're talking about. And so, I would,
Judge Larkin, I'm having a hard time with this argument. I'm just sort of big picture here because I have a criminal defense background. You know, when we talk about incompetency findings in the context of criminal court, you know, we're essentially saying, look, if somebody doesn't understand what they're doing is wrong or the consequences of their action, or they're incapable of communicating with their attorney or participating in their defense, we're not going to hold them criminally liable. We're not going to punish them and put them on probation or put them in jail. So, you know, a person is excused from the consequences of their action because they didn't know what they were doing was wrong. It really comes down to mens rea. I don't know that concern is at play in a civil context, because it seems like there's enough here in this record to suggest that he knew what he was doing. He mistakenly perceived a need to harm somebody, and then he took action that any reasonable person would know would harm somebody. And I think his own statements indicate that he was trying to harm somebody. So it's like the part of this that's associated with his mental health is his reasons for doing it. And that sounds like the mens rea part. Did he have an evil mind? Would we hold him accountable criminally? No. But why shouldn't he be responsible in a civil context? Why shouldn't he have to compensate the victim for the damage he caused? We're not talking about putting him in prison. So there we would excuse, you know, the inability to understand right from wrong. Why would we excuse it here? I mean, if he says, you know, it wasn't an accident, you know, I picked up this object and I hit him because I thought he had spiked my beer and I wanted to hurt him, why shouldn't he be civilly responsible for that?
Well, Your Honor, I think that gets to probably a deeper and larger policy argument or discussion than what
I know it's a policy discussion, but I hear everybody talking and saying, okay, well, we all agree there needs to be intent to succeed on the assault and battery claim. And the intent that needs to be proved is intent to cause harm. Is that it?
Intent to cause harm, intent to conduct the act.
Why isn't there sufficient evidence in this record to show that your client intended to cause harm?
I read this to say, from a non-psychiatric expertise sort of background, to say that if someone doesn't know the nature of what they're doing, regardless of what the reasons are, and perhaps the faulty reasons that they are acting in the way they are, if they don't know the nature of what they are doing, or it was wrong, which would be the bad consequence, I interpret them to say, when you know something is going to lead to a bad consequence, I read that to say, you know that it's wrong. So if you don't know that it's wrong, and you don't know the nature or the act that you're engaging in, which would be, what am I doing? How can you have the intent?
Let me stop you there, because it seems like you're giving examples of a lot of different things. I would agree with you. If someone is in a psychotic state and they literally don't know what they're doing, that's one thing, but that's not what the record necessarily shows here. There's evidence in the record, I believe, that shows, well, he knew what he was doing. He had a plan to do what he did, and he accomplished it. And what we're honing in on is, well, was that a sane plan? I mean, did he understand that that was wrong? Did he understand that his reasons for doing that were disconnected from reality? I don't know that those concerns necessarily equate with a finding that he did not intend to cause harm. Now, maybe I think what we're talking about is, why did he think there was a reason to cause harm? That's what the mental health concerns seem to address. But I don't know that that matters in this context, because if the intent is merely to cause harm, and there's evidence in the record that indicates he perceived a need to cause harm and he intentionally acted to cause harm and did cause harm, why isn't that enough? Why does it matter that his reason for doing so was not based in fact?
If I could follow up, Judge Bradfold referenced WICA and its cites to the Restatement of Torts. And specifically, she talked about Section 895J, Comment C. And to Judge Larkin's point, the restatement gives an example, which is A, who is mentally ill, believes that he is Napoleon Bonaparte, and that B, his nurse, who confines him to his room, is an agent of the Duke of Wellington, who is endeavoring to prevent his arrival on the field of Waterloo in time to win the battle, clearly delusional. Seeking to escape, he breaks off the leg of a chair, attacks the nurse with it, fractures her skull. And the conclusion is A is subject to liability in tort to B for the battery. It seems that that's what we have here.
Your Honor, I disagree with both from a policy standpoint and what I think that this report says and what we have here, and that is, shall a person be condemned to personal liability for mental illness and effects of that, of actions arising out of that? I'm not so sure.
To Judge Larkin's point, I think of condemnation as a criminal punishment. You're condemned to prison. I think of tort liability as you hurt someone and maybe you should be liable for that. Not condemned, but liable for it.
And counsel, this is fascinating, because we're talking about mental health, but another question just came into my mind. What if there was somebody who, a woman, she wakes up, there's someone in her house, she doesn't recognize him, she shoots. And he survives, but he's injured. And it turns out it's, her college son's friend came to spend the night. He was drunk. He's been there before. He came into the house. She didn't know he was coming to the house. And so she says, self-defense. You know, I reasonably believed I was in harm for my safety, and that's why I shot. And we might say under the criminal law, yeah, she had a reasonable belief as a woman alone in her house that it was okay to shoot this intruder. She shouldn't be prosecuted. If we follow your logic, would we say, well, she shouldn't be civilly liable either, you know, because she mistakenly thought it was okay to shoot, therefore she shouldn't have to pay the victim's hospital bills? I mean, it's two completely different things.
I would agree, Your Honor, and I would point out that we did assert a self-defense, affirmative defense that was not adjudicated below. And but I would also say that those two scenarios that you described and one that we have here are very distinguishable in the sense that her actions or inactions were not clouded by a cloud of mental illness that precluded her.
Well, okay. So let's stop
precluded
there.
Her from
I'm not
establishing that.
Because if we're talking about, what we're talking about is, why did you do what you do? What were you thinking? And I don't know why we would say, well, you were mistaken in your thinking, your rational, sound mind, but given the circumstances, you made an honest mistake, as opposed to you weren't of sound mind, you weren't rationally thinking. Either way, we've got a person with an injury who's looking for compensation, which we favor. So unless we were to have some, you know, we're talking about policy here, it seems to me the policy you want is no mentally ill person should ever be responsible for any harm they cause, so long as the harm stemmed from their mental illness. I mean, is that what you're arguing? I mean, you're saying, well, this stems from his mental illness, therefore he should not be civilly responsible.
Your Honor, I guess that portrayal or illustration would be a little broader than what I would say that I'm arguing. I think that if this act was simply, if this person did not have the capability of establishing intent as required by the tort rules that we have, the elements of the claim, then this expert, whose report is the only evidence in the record, which the judge had, this is the only uncontroverted evidence he had on intent. This establishes that he did not know the nature or the wrong element of wrongdoing that of his act. And there is nothing else for the judge to conclude what he concluded on. And I think just real quickly, there's a lot of statements in the.
We're well past your time. So I think I'll cut you off there and we'll go back for a rebuttal argument at this point.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief, Your Honor. Going to the Victor v. Sell, intent or intentionality means that the actor desires to cause consequences of his act or that he believes that the consequences are substantially certain to result from it. Looking at Dr. Bauerman's report and the sections that I cited, it doesn't seem to be in dispute that Mr. Pavlich meant to pick up the pipe, meant to strike Mr. Miller in the back of the head with it, and knew the resulting harm would occur. With that, I think that the district court's grant of summary judgment was wrong and that it should be remanded.
Any other questions for counsel? All right. Well, thank you, gentlemen, for your arguments and your briefing. It's an interesting issue. We appreciate having the opportunity to decide it, and you'll have our decision within 90 days. That concludes the hearing.
Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors.